This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I'm a composer, and I live right now between Wellington and Dunedin, mostly Dunedin this year. But I consider myself basically a Wellingtonian. I've been here since just before high school, and before that, I grew up in Hamilton, and then moved down when I was about 10 or 11. And then went to high school in Wellington, did undergraduate and a little bit of postgraduate at Victoria University in Wellington, and then I lived overseas. I lived in the States, upstate New York, at a little town called Ithaca, where I also did some study, and in New York City after that, before coming back to New Zealand about, 5 or 6 years ago.
And the reason you are commuting between Wellington and Dunedin is because you are the current Mozart Fellow?
That's right, yeah. The Mozart Fellowship is the composition or the music fellowship that's run by the University of Otago. So there's a writer's one called the Rob Burns Fellowship. There's a visual arts one called the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship, and a couple of other different ones that are run out of different departments. But the music one is the Mozart Fellowship.
So how did you get into composing?
I played piano when I was a kid, quite poorly, and I was a really terrible piano student because I didn't really like practicing that much. And I was always quite good at sight reading, so I would sight read at my lessons. It was terrible. I'd never really practiced anything. I was dreadful. But at high school, I got into composition. I had a really good sort of composition itinerant teacher named Gary Wilby, who used to come into our high school, and he introduced me to some things that I really fell in love with, things like music by people like Stockhausen, Lutosławski, and other contemporary composers, and I really I found that fascinating, and those sorts of moments that broaden your horizons, that blow your mind, they're really interesting. So I got into composing then, and I've been doing it ever since. So I would have been about 16 when I started, and it's almost 20 years ago.
So what was it about contemporary composition that, that really kind of fired you up? What can you describe? What were the things that kind of...
I think the main thing is that it was a feeling that anything could happen, and that anything was possible. And that's not something that you always experience, especially, you know, when you're a student, you don't have the kind of ability that professionals have, and so you don't always feel that you're in control of the sounds you want to make if you're a performer, or if you're just sort of learning about things. But just hearing a universe that can imagine any kind of combination of sounds and make it logical and to some degree beautiful, I found that really, really special and quite poignant.
And that's really interesting, because when you think about things like, say, Beethoven, which is very kind of stable, and you know, you have a sense that this is how it goes. Mm. It's interesting that you're kind of going for quite the opposite, where actually anything can.
Yeah, and in some ways, with things like repertoire, Beethoven and Mozart, I've kind of come back to them, but with this idea that historically what they were doing was also, you know, really broadening horizons and really blowing people's minds. In today's context, it seems much more traditional, much more conventional, but in their own contexts, it was quite experimental, I guess you could say. They were really pushing the boundaries as well. But that's just something I think that was really attractive to the teenage me, and actually remains very attractive. I think I still find things in other people's music, and hopefully in my own music as well, that are little discoveries that broaden the possibilities, the realm of possibilities, and I'm always looking for that, I think.
So how do you react to listening to your own work?
It's interesting because it's, because you know it so well. It's existed in your imagination for so long. When you do finally hear a performance, that when you are hearing it, it's it can be almost surreal, and sometimes it's almost that you have to force yourself into a situation where you listen almost objectively, as if you're listening to someone else's work. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to be professional, have a sense of what needs to happen with it. Usually, it can be really overwhelming, and sometimes it's terrifying, especially first rehearsals, because you know, I write tricky stuff and it takes a little while to get together, and sometimes if you're at the first rehearsal it can be a bit heartbreaking, but in the right circumstances I'm sometimes moved in unusual ways, and I think for the way that other people would listen to it would be quite different. I think that what I hear in it is maybe that it has sort of different features or different, I don't know, salient points of interest for me than others.
And it must be really useful in the rehearsal process to actually have the composer there so that you can actually discuss with the musicians what you're intending, and they can...
I think yes and no. I think sometimes the composer can get in the way, but there's with rehearsals of any sort, there's those little magic moments where it's all kind of working and the entire mechanism is working as it should, and sometimes exactly as you said, the composer can really offer insight into how it goes, but sometimes it's just impractical. But it's great to be there for rehearsals. It's great to, when it's going well, it's the most fun that music can ever be. Rehearsals more than performances, actually. When it's going well and everyone's engaged, it's pretty amazing music making.
So what you imagine to begin with, does that translate easily onto the page? Do you find that what actually ends up in the rest of us hearing, is it the same as what you hear?
Yes, I'd say most of the time. I'm quite a slow composer. I'm quite detail oriented, and so I think very, very hard about every detail and every note and every rhythm, and I know that most composers, I feel like most composers do think quite hard about it as well. I just think it's just something that I really sink my teeth into, and because of that, it's so well worked out in my head that when it is on the page, it is just so. There's obviously room for interpretation in certain regards, but basically, I think what I'm going for comes out 95% of the time, yeah.
And another interesting thing, I guess, is that you're working in such detail and spending a lot of time over it, but for an audience, they're hearing it in real time. So the I suppose that time span is quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lovely tension, and actually it's something that I think composers all exploit, or they all explore, I guess, is the amount of mystery that music has. It's not something that's immediate. It's not something that's transparent. It's something where you can create kind of clouds and in a sort of hazy quality, no matter what the expression is, and that's something that composers have always used. You know, that's why Bach is so contrapuntal. It toys with the mechanism of how people hear things, and that's a really beautiful thing. In fact, for me, transparency and clarity are less desirable than kind of mystery and that sort of cloudy aspect. Yeah.
So are you writing for an audience, or are you writing for yourself? Who are you writing for?
Yes to both, I think. Yeah, so I'd like to think of myself as an audience member, and I always like to say that I write for the listener, and then that it can be said that it's whoever cares to listen to it. But I think that, you know, audiences are smart, and they have an appetite for things that are slightly outside of the box, and that's what I do, or what I try and do. And while not everyone's going to be engaged by that immediately, I think that there's possibility for any audience member to find something there.
And like you were saying earlier, that in his time, Beethoven was kind of out of the box, and now is seen as quite standard. Mm. So it's interesting, isn't it, how kind of, you know, fashions and what people consider to be mainstream changes.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, the people in all realms of music, I think there are people who are trying to push the boundaries. It's just with what I do, it's probably the boundary pushing aspects of it are probably the most salient aspect to an audience. That's probably what strikes them straight away, rather than for you know, pop music or something like that, where there might be people who are trying to explore different things. It's just the salient aspects are the more immediate and kind of easily recognisable.
So if I said to you, name one emotion that you were, what was the main emotion in your music? What would that kind of emotion be?
I'd like to think that there are quite a few, but for me, I like the idea of aggression, or latent aggression, and that sounds, it's not necessarily that all of my music is violent, but I think there's an aggressive quality that I think comes out of a few different places. I often think about the way that in Maori culture, the way that you greet a group of visitors, or the way that people come together, the kind of ceremony and the kind of ritual has elements of aggression in it, but it's not in order to frighten people, it's in order to welcome them, you know, and there are obviously traditional reasons for that, but there's a sort of beauty in that, and I think a quality that I'm attracted to. It happens in other cultures as well. There's a Korean music theatre style called pansori, and there's a real sort of defiant kind of aggression, and Motetia, the old Maori songs have this as well. So I think that kind of quality is quite special to me. My music doesn't sound like these things really, but it's that sort of emotional quality that I am quite attracted to.
This year is the 30th anniversary of homosexual law reform. And so I thought, oh, I'll bring the two strands together. How do you think sexuality and music composition interweave, or do they, or don't they? How is it for you?
It's really hard to say, actually, because I think it's pretty different depending on where you are in history. In my lifetime, it's gone from being illegal to be gay to being basically pretty widely accepted, and so I think that some of the kind of real world challenges that older gay composers had are just never going to be the reality for me or for gay composers around my age. So, you know, what links me and Tchaikovsky? Nothing really, you know, in terms of that. So I wonder how much, obviously it's a part of my life to be gay, and it's, you know, a big part of my universe, but I don't know if it translates to, you know, the notes on the page, are there gay chords in my music or anything like that. But I think looking at other composers throughout history, so, you know, whether they're in New Zealand, people like Jack Boddy, even Douglas Lilburn, the impact that it had would be really different for them, because it was a different time. It was, and there were much, much bigger challenges. You know, Douglas, I think, was basically closeted, you could say, and so that's definitely going to have an impact on the way he works. The same with, you know, older composers, sort of in the 19th century, people like Tchaikovsky, Ravel, whereas somebody like John Cage, it was probably an asset. You know, he was able to communicate with both his partner, Merce Cunningham, and other people in the gay community. And so it's really hard to say exactly what kind of impact it would have on me. I don't know if there's a kind of, if there's something in my music that reflects it or not. I think only other people could really say.
Has it been an area that you've wanted to kind of explore in terms of?
I'm not really sure. I guess if I was looking at sort of extra musical subjects, then there might be things that could come up. I don't know. Probably the closest thing these days, I'm sort of looking at sounds from my everyday life and creating transcriptions of like little kind of sound samples, whether there'd be like a bird call or something really simple like the pattern of speech or kind of water dripping into a glass or something like this, and transcribing them and resynthesizing them, orchestrating them in different circumstances. And the last piece I finished had I used a little kind of clip of an obscure disco song, and that it doesn't, you can't hear it in the piece, it's not, there's no kind of sonic line drawn between that and the result, but I guess because it's in the background, maybe there's some aspect of this that the kind of quotidian existence has an element of gay culture, at least, albeit from a different time and a time before I was born. So that's another thing. But yeah, something that I find that I'm fond of and that I find interesting.
Maybe it's a kind of a wider than composition question, I guess, in terms of as a younger gay man, do you feel that you need to be out there as a gay person, or it's just part of your life?
I feel like I need to be honest, upfront, and natural about being a gay person, that it is a part of my life. I don't feel any need to behave in any way other than what I feel comes natural. And I feel really lucky that I can live in a time when I can do that, that I can just be myself, I can be gay, I can have a boyfriend, and we can walk around town like normal people and have Christmas with my family and go to my nieces and nephews' birthday parties, and that it's all totally fine. Maybe it's not totally fine to everyone, but they don't say so, and it's no trouble for them. It's no skin off their nose. So I feel really kind of fortunate in that regard, and that I don't have to hide anything about myself or act in any particular way. It's really an asset.
you mentioned earlier about Jack Boddy, or you just name checked Jack. You had quite a close friendship with Jack, and I'm just wondering, he passed a year ago, just over a year ago. What was Jack like?
Jack was a kind of amazing guy. He was magnanimous as a personality and as a human being. He was very personable and very familial. Both he and Yono, his partner, they were always very welcoming, and a great musical mind as well, and somebody who really did like to engage with other musicians that he saw talent in, or whose music he found interesting. So I was really lucky to be part of Jack's circle, both in New Zealand and overseas. When you go overseas and you're from New Zealand and you're involved in contemporary music, they'll always ask you if you know Jack. He's the one that everyone knows. So which is a reflection on his personality, but also on his kind of generosity of spirit. It could be you know, tricky sometimes. He had lots of ideas, and he wanted to do a lot of things, and you often had a job to do. So that was something that, and including after his passing, I still had work to do for him, which was interesting, but that's part of being a friend to Jack. But he really did like the idea of family, and I use that both in the kind of the sense of gay parents, but also just the idea of having people around him and close to him that he could provide kind of support to in this way. And it was almost from the get-go a much closer relationship than you'd expect. He was much more intimate and much more interested in your life in general than you would expect from a composition teacher. So, but he was really kind and very generous, especially professionally. He really provided a lot of opportunity to me and to other people in my situation as well. I really think I wouldn't be a composer if it wasn't for Jack. He was both the reason that I wanted to study at a high level, and he provided the kind of opportunities that meant that I could become professional and sort of make that next step.
What kind of ongoing impact do you think he will have on you?
I think about Jack quite a lot, actually, and sometimes when I'm working on something, or if I'm at a concert somewhere, or if there's something coming up, I always think to myself, I think Jack would really love this. I think he'd find this really exciting, and that's, I know I'm not alone in that. I think that a lot of people find that about the work that they do. He has a presence, I guess. I think that he's also made me want to explore the idea of community and to try and enrich that sense of community within New Zealand composition and new music. And I think that's really something that a debt that we owe Jack and New Zealand music. And I think that's something that has to continue. Probably, you know, he was just one guy who was able to do all these things, and I think it'll take more than one guy to to do more of this going forward, but that's definitely something that that I feel is his legacy.
He always struck me as just this, he was like an energizer bunny, you know. It's just like the most amazing amount of energy. And so many projects on the go at one, in any one time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I think that's what, partly why everyone always had a job to do, because he was just doing so much. And and walking into Jack's office or into his home, it sometimes felt like you were hit with a wall of stuff to do and think about, which was great. It was exciting, but also hard work. And so, yeah, he was tireless and really dedicated to this. And yeah, we've all got to step up a little bit, I think.
And he actually wrote a number of quite homoerotic pieces, didn't he? I'm thinking of the Michelangelo sonnets and also the Rewiali opera.
Rewiali opera and a piece called Stations of the Cross, which is a solo piano piece that he wrote for Dan Poynton. But there's quite a lot of, it's almost choreographic in the way it's written, and there's definitely a lot of sort of homoerotic imagery and theatricality in it. Yeah.
Must be quite interesting just to go back and look at say like Jack's work, but also earlier say like Lilburn's work, and see, I mean, do you see kind of homoerotic elements or homosexual elements say like in Lilburn's work?
It's really hard to say, and Jack wrote a little article for the Composers Association yearbook, which is called Canzona, a few years ago, and I'm not sure if I see anything necessarily in Lilburn's work that's homoerotic. I think a lot of it is about masculinity, though, in a certain sense. I'm thinking in particular of Sings Harry and The Return. Those are the two that I think have elements of masculinity and kind of New Zealand masculinity, which is interesting. But I think what Jack's article, if I remember it rightly, sort of suggested was that Lilburn had these kind of obsessions and that somehow reflected a kind of gay sensibility. I don't know if I agree, but it's there. I'm trying to think of many gay composers and what elements of their music has that kind of sensibility or elements of homoerotic imagery. And obviously Britten is an obvious example, because these operas were often around gay themes, especially Death in Venice and Peter Grimes. But for John Cage or Samuel Barber or Ravel, I'm not really sure if that kind of applies, if that's something that's there. But with Jack, I think it was really something that he felt the need to do, and I think it was something that really fascinated him. He was also, Jack's sense of humour was really amazing, and he had this preoccupation with kitsch, which is really interesting. And so things like the kind of I guess it's like an oratorio, but what he did about Carmen Rupe, there's an awful lot of kind of kitsch in that, and it's really interesting and quite sort of cute and quaint in a way, which is nice.
A few years ago, I think it was maybe 2013, Samuel Holloway put on a concert in Auckland that I think was billed as the first concert featuring all rainbow composers from New Zealand. And I was wondering, how do you see something like that concert? Like, I mean, if you're not saying that you can see gay elements in your composition, but to be included in a concert that is specifically about rainbow composers. I guess the question is, are you happy to see yourself as a gay composer?
Of course, yes. And I think when you're programming concerts, if you want to build a link in, it can sometimes feel a little bit arbitrary, but it's something that you can do to tie a concert together. And that concert had an amazing range of composers, if I remember rightly. David Hamilton, I think Samuel might have had a piece in there, Claire Cowan. These are very, very different and distinct voices. So I think using some kind of underlying or background element to tie something that has an enormous amount of variety together is interesting in itself. So of course there's being programmed in a concert like that would be interesting regardless, especially if it was approached in that way, in the sense of variety.
You were saying that you're currently working on a composition that's dealing with kind of everyday sounds and resynthesizing them. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so I tend to make little recordings or use recordings of very, very small things and then transcribe them. So notate their kind of the rhythm and pitch quality, but using technology now, you can also transcribe their colour, so the amount of the upper partials or the harmonic series that's resonating, that's not that prominent, not as prominent as their fundamental pitch, but that kind of gives them colour, and because of that, it's sort of you're able to explore the things that make, I don't know, a guitar sound like a guitar or a bell sound like a bell, that sort of thing. And those elements that give it that colour are often a little bit chaotic and very interesting sonically. And so they're the sorts of things that I like to kind of resonate throughout my pieces and explore in detail. So that's what I've been doing, and that's, I guess, it creates a non-abstract, it's still a sonic link, but a link to these sounds that's not about the context necessarily, but about the way they resonate and the way they reverberate in both space and also in memory. It's something that I like.
So how do you pick those sounds initially? What sparks you when you hear something around you?
It's usually an attractive quality to the colour. If for me something like water dripping into a glass has a lot of interesting colour to me, it's a little bit chaotic as a sound and also quite beautiful, but actually in some senses picking the sounds can be almost arbitrary, just because they're just something that's part of your life or part of your everyday existence, and so it's that element that I like, and from there it's all about the working out is what ends up being the composition, the working out of what the little minutiae are that make up the sound.
So in about a month's time you're heading back down to Dunedin?
Yeah, so I'll be back in a few weeks, yeah, and be back at the music school then. Yeah.
And so when you're at the music school, what kind of wisdom do you impart on for younger composers?
I don't know if there's anything in particular that I impart. I tend to just, I like to see what people are up to and see what they like in music and what kind of things they're doing, and then look for ways that I can possibly expand on that and find ways to inject inject little sort of aspects or moments of interest and kind of encourage them to explore the extremes of some of these things. But usually I think that composers always, they have ideas and it's about getting those ideas to be more fruitful and finding ways to get them to both work but also to sort of be much more lateral and much broader as musical ideas.
So you're still quite like young, but there's a generation coming up after. So I'm guessing you're interacting with the next generation coming up.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah, I'm not so young.
Oh, no, you're not. But do you see much difference between, say, like your age group and the people coming through now?
Absolutely. Yeah, there is a difference, and I think the difference is partly due to technology. I'm a pencil and paper composer, and that's always how I learnt, and I also, you know, I was a composer who used to just go to the libraries and look at scores, so that was how I worked. I think younger composers have a better grasp, but much more access to technology. A lot of them don't write anything down. They work straight on computers. They do a lot of listening, but they have access to libraries all over the place. You know, I used to have to go to the library and find things. So, yeah, I'm finding that they're much more digitally sort of aware, and that's a big change, but. You know, otherwise you see a lot of comparisons, and it's nice to be able to talk about when you were their age or you were at their stage of composition. So, yeah.